Okay, this is continuing with Cyril Hazard on 3rd June 1981. Continuing, that is, from March 1973 in Groningen and September 1978 also here at the Institute of Astronomy in Cambridge. The Mark I telescope, I did ask you before about did you think that this was the obvious way to go, and you said yes, well, you'd had good success with the 218-foot, and obviously it'd be nice to have a steerable telescope with better pointing and so forth. But overall, did you feel that that was the way to put a lot of money in a Jodrell bank? Would you have been in favor of that, or would you have favored a different approach?
I think probably at that time that I wasn't sufficiently involved in that type of thinking.
So you were just a junior staff member, you're
that's
saying?
That's right. I think that we were keen on it, Henry Brown, myself, you know, but only in the sense, I think, that we had been using the other one. Obviously, you could get a tremendous amount of stuff if you had a fully steerable one. The other thing is, I mean, I do remember saying to Henry Brown once, maybe, over that period, you know, why don't, you know, another way would be to build, two lines of things and cross them. I mean, I didn't work out the details, but the sort of thing, I mean, I think that idea must have occurred to many people at the time, that you could build, some sort of interferometer system. Mm-hmm. I mean, how you would do it, I mean, I wasn't thinking of any of the details, but I think the sort of thing that happened there was that we really weren't doing any interferometry at all at the time. I mean, Jennison was doing some of the stuff on angular sizes, but that was
a specialized kind of interferometer.
This is up to 1950. Because this thing was thought of, I mean, I suppose,
around 50,
almost concurrently with the bringing into operation of the 210.
Almost, yes.
You know, I mean, so that
it was a year or two later, I think.
Yeah, but I mean, but the ideas, I think, were probably... See, Clegg was one of the main movies. You know, Clegg gets squeezed out of a lot of these.
Well, I interviewed him over the phone just a week ago.
Yeah.
So
he's still knocking around.
He's still knocking around, yes. He's retired in...
What did he say?
Down there, Worthing.
How does he feel about it?
Well, he basically left because he felt the place was getting to be... a big science, and that he would lose his hands-on ability, which he very much liked, and so forth. But I think he sort of took it philosophically in that it was inevitable that you had to go to bigger things, but personally...
I think there are some other reasons that we want to come into that as well, but... I think there was probably some conflicts as well. I suppose that he wasn't happy about other things as well, But he himself, I think, did the design essentially. Have you seen the blue book?
Oh, yes.
Seen that?
Oh, yes.
I've
seen that.
See, most of that is Clegg, I think. I mean, mm-hmm. The design of the mm-hmm. of the telescope and so on. And I would say that at that particular time, everybody. Well, there weren't many people doing radio astronomy. I mean, essentially, at that
the passive.
The Jodrell bank thing was had to be, I think, looked at in rather different terms to the way that you would look at the Cambridge setup, in the sense that the actual effort on extragalactic work at that particular time, or on radio surveys, I don't suppose you'd say extragalactic specifically, was only a relatively small part of the total operation,
mm-hmm. right.
And only grew after that rather than before. So I think also, there may have been a difference that perhaps they were more in contact down here with theoreticians and so on.
You think so?
Well, at least there was Hoyle and so on, and other people, you know, sort of talking about...
Well, that was a strange kind of contact, but...
Oh, but it's still a contact of some type, I think.
Yeah.
And
there was no one like that at Manchester University.
That you could say, well, there was Kopal was in the university, I think, around about that time.
And Kahn was a little bit later, I guess.
Kahn was slightly later, I think, you know, before the input came in, yes. And I think that...
Was Reddish there even for a short while?
Reddish came, but Reddish came quite a bit later on. I can't remember when Reddish came. Come in. can't remember when Reddish came. Reddish, did Reddish come?
I'm not sure.
54 or 57.
I would have thought it would be around that time, but of course you were away for 3 years, so it might have been while you were away.
It came when I was there. But I think it was about 57. I think it would be that time. I think it came when I got back. He was there.
But the point was, you felt you weren't having much contact with these people, even if they were there.
Well, that was later on. I think that things had changed by 57 or so. And I think, you know, when I went back again, you know, I don't think things had changed at all, but I'd changed and. And maybe we were doing different things by then, and the thing was moving, you know, faster by then. But up to 54, which is over the region you were talking about, I don't think that we didn't know any astronomy.
Yeah.
I think that was the thing.
Okay, but now here's the irony of it that I wanted to ask about, is that it seems like right from the very beginning that all of your work, along with Hanbury Brown, was to do with, strongly to do with optical objects. You were looking for the optical nebulae.
That's right.
You were always trying to correlate. You set up radio magnitude scales.
Yes, that's right.
Why was this?
I don't know, really.
Neither of you were trained as optical astronomers.
No.
There were no optical astronomers around.
It shows in some of the early stuff
right.
when you look back, I think.
But why was it that you were making this effort?
I think it was historical in the sense that we started off with looking at M31, I suppose, and which is what
Hanbury
Brown was when he first came, you know, back, and I think that it followed on from there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, but it probably accounts for why I switched later on
to optical astronomy.
I mean, and my interest moved away because. I think that the work did lead in that mm-hmm. direction.
Okay. Another question along these lines is, Jodrell Bank obviously has been one of the leading radio astronomy labs through the 50s. What do you think has been the main key to that success? Which components?
What do you think is the success? I mean, that's the first thing.
Well, I think your work with Hanbury Brown was quite good in distinguishing the radio galaxies, as we call them now, from normal nebulae and the class 1 and class 2. And Mills was doing some of this too, but nevertheless,
what I meant by that is that I think that I just wanted to get clear, you know, what you meant, because, you know, I tend to look at a smaller part of the whole operation.
Well, I'm also thinking of the radar work. There was lunar radar work
that
was interesting. Also, ionospheric work, establishing the nature of the scintillations. And of course, there was a lot of meteor radar, which is sort of a separate field.
See, I feel that personally, that the success of Jodrell Bank, the main success of Jodrell Bank, wasn't so much in the work that was done there, although I think that a lot of that was important.
Yes.
A lot of very good stuff was done, as in the radar work and the media stuff. I think, you know, had a very big impact. You know, doesn't talk about it.
Well, now, I forgot to mention the intensity interferometer also.
And to develop an intensity interferometer. Well.
But what do you feel is the?
I think the fertilization of the whole field. I think that the impact of people from Jodrell Bank in radio astronomy as a whole has been very large. I think probably larger than almost any other group, maybe except some of the Australians. I think if you look around the world and go to various establishments and check who's there, then I think you've got a very good chance of finding an old Jodrell Bank person there. And so I think that the sum total of the amount of work which has been done by people who have spent some time at Jodrell It's very large.
So it's been a training ground.
I think it's been a very good training ground, and I think that that accounts for some of the other stuff that you were talking about, is that it wasn't a very structured place. It was split up into groups, fairly small groups who operated almost independently. I think one of Lovell's great strengths was that he really didn't interfere with anybody, and he let everybody do what they wanted. You know, that's without being critical. I mean, making a comparison, I mean, Edge and all these people have written these comparisons of various places. I don't know how true they really are, because I think you have to be in the system to see how it was. But it, as I remember Jodrell Bank in the early days, I mean, one of the, I would say, the more striking things about it was that it was a pretty, you know, a very lively, active and very friendly place. You know, we all enjoyed ourselves. I think that was the, it was a big game, I think. I mean, we really did enjoy ourselves. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were out there in the country and, you know, everybody, although they're in different groups scattered around the field and working on different things, did interact very strongly.
Helping with building aerials?
Or? Oh, well, not talking with each other, because we were mixed, the media groups were in the same, you know, we had Greenhow and his media stuff next, you know, in the same hut as us and so on. I think that we, no, I mean, I just even think that we would get out on a nice day and play cricket. They all move out of the field with our antennas and so on. I mean, we really, it really was a...
Socially.
In the place itself, I don't think necessarily outside we didn't mix very much, but the place itself was heavy. I think that there was no line to follow. We didn't have any particular...
No vision, so to speak.
I don't think we had a vision in that sense, and I think that because we were too small at that time, which maybe had its faults, of course, it later on as the... I think by building a general purpose instrument, like the 250-foot, and going for the general purpose type instruments, to some extent you can, well, it can slow up the development of a particular line, I think, which a special purpose instrument, which is built by everybody, so, you know, as the Cambridge instruments, focuses attention much more closely on a problem.
Right.
I think at that time, to some extent we were looking for problems, I suppose, and the general purpose instrument dictates a different type of approach.
But in that sense it was really a continuation of the lack of one line beforehand, because now everyone could do his own little thing on the big dish.
On the big dish, and I think that, of course, that was only true, I would say, up to about the coming of the big dish, because I think that with the increase in information and so on, and I think the integration over the next several years of radio astronomy gradually coming into the mainstream and its real impact on astronomy, because I mean up to 52 it had very little real impact on astronomy as such. I mean, not many optical astronomers were taking a great deal of notice. But after the mid-1950s it was, it was starting to get integrated into the system, and the whole thing was starting to change, I think, and I think that the radio astronomers were gradually getting more and more involved in the astronomy and so on that they worked for. I mean, I would say still, you know, to some extent that, I mean, I was learning some electronic engineering the first few years and working on antennas, and, you know, to some extent, I suppose that we were more interested in doing some of that sort of thing than what came out. I mean, I remember, you know, you see, it was a great sense of achievement when you built the receiver and put it on the antenna, you got the source coming through, you know, I mean, it seems ridiculous now, but I mean, even to get the signal coming through, I mean, we thought that it was an achievement, and you're going to get that sense of achievement now, of course. I mean,
it has to come now from the astronomy end of it.
It has to come from the astronomy now. In the beginning, I think, there was this sense of achievement. You were building all your own equipment, and of course, Jodrell's always done that. And I think that's another sense where it's different to many places. Maybe overdid it, I think, in the beginning of necessity, because there was no money.
Well, I'm not sure it's different from other places at that time, though. Radio physics in Sydney, of course, did that, and here Cambridge did that. And
yeah, but I think it's had. I think it's gone on longer doing that.
Oh, I see. You're talking about through the '60s.
Well, I think J.G. Davis still designs, you know, the computer things for the telescopes and so on. I think an awful lot of the, is pretty...
But at what era would you say that kind of approach became less profitable if you were interested in getting astronomy?
I think it was starting to get less profitable, I think, towards the end of the 50s. Mm-hmm. I mean, because I think that, you know, I mean, I think that the end... Well, you had a conflict. I mean, the early radio astronomers, the successful ones, I think, Hanbury Brown, Mills, Ryle, I think Bolton probably as well, I'm not quite sure, and were engineers with an engineering background, because that's because it was the initial was the application of engineering to astronomy, and the problems were technical in the beginning.
Right.
I mean, so it was that aspect of it that I think that was interesting. I think there were some interesting problems. But I mean, you know, I mean, even stabilized power supplies weren't particularly in existence in those days, you know, and things like that. So you had, you know, you've got quite an ordinary plans to get stable power supplies.
I mean, that was a contribution to electronics. I mean, learning how to.
That's right. So at the beginning, it was electronics that was the thing, I think. But the engineers, of course, the engineering aspects were very important in developing the new techniques and so on, because it required a pretty profound understanding of noise and stuff like that, I think, which they all had. As the techniques developed, and I think the information began to come in bigger amounts, then I think that you had the problem started to shift. And plus the fact, I think, that the people who were recruited, apart from, say, Jerry Hawkins, perhaps, I think, was one of the few who had any knowledge of astronomy in the beginning, the Jodrell anyhow. The people that were recruited were physics people. The recruitment was from the physics department. And so apart from people, I think, who had, you know, their own interest in electronics, I mean, people were coming into what was a fairly technical subject with very little knowledge of electronics to begin with.
Right.
No knowledge of antennas and so on in general, and so that you had to start and learn that part of the subject first as well. Now, as the stuff got more and more complicated, I think this became a pretty unprofitable sort of way to spend your time. And it was recognised, obviously, by the hiring of Reddish, you know, which I think was around about 57 or something like that. Now, obviously, the climate wasn't right. I mean, to do that, it got obviously, because it didn't, you know, I don't think, he didn't stay very long. I mean, I don't know what... We know what happened, but presumably it was difficult for an optical astronomer
to fit
into this system, which still hadn't made the wholehearted change over to an astronomical observatory. Now I think it's quite easy.
Yeah. Well, let me ask about. It seems a bit peculiar to me to have some passive observations going on, and you were doing a large fraction of them, but not, of course, it was.